body test, as we've been discussing, there's no way to say that they're likely to develop AIDS. So we'd have to assume that at least 80% of those individuals are going to get turned down when they apply for insurance coverage, that they're never going to have the medical problem that the insurance industry is worried about. And of course, there's the issue also of given that, sort of, if that is correct, that 80% figure, that those individuals should be insured, we just don't know who is in the 80% group. There's a question about the fairness then of denying them the coverage and eliminating coverage for individuals who actually might develop AIDS, who otherwise could pay into the system as an insurance subscriber and for years before there are any signs, any symptoms of the illness actually develop. But they may have had the antibody and the virus for years and years before that ever develops.
Is it legal for an insurance company to ask for a blood test, and are there insurance companies already doing that?
Well, this varies state by state. In Wisconsin, there was a statewide law adopted which very severely restricted the insurance company's ability to do that sort of testing. And the insurance industry has a very effective lobby, and they managed to get that provision reversed so that they are able to test. And this varies from state to state. Generally, state laws on insurance bar discrimination, say, on the basis of sex or marital status. So they couldn't discriminate against all single men in metropolitan areas, for example. But they probably can, under current law, give that kind of test. And that's going to be one of the big disputes and issues that undoubtedly will be debated in the legislatures about whether or not insurance companies are allowed to do that kind of testing.
Insurance companies play the odds. They hope they insure you and nothing's going to happen. Are they trying to screen out people who they consider to be high-risk situations? And are there leading questions showing up on forms now designed to screen out the high-risk population people?
Well, there have been some instances I know of on a national basis where the AIDS antibody test has been administered before they would consider insuring an individual. Now, that has come up, and there are complaints about that sort of thing going on. But in general, at this point, they're not changing the application forms, although maybe they're in the works now. It's certainly something they're concerned about, so there aren't really significant changes in insurance companies' approaches. And they've said recently, some of the underwriters, that they're not changing their approach on this. But that may happen. In fact, I advise gay clients of mine, if they're looking at their insurance coverage, they may want to consider applying for insurance now, obtaining coverage before the standards change and it becomes extremely difficult to get the insurance without going through a very intrusive process of being tested or examined regarding these particular health issues.
My guest is David Weber, and he's the legal director for the Advocacy Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force. He's also legal counsel for the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force. There have been a lot of controversies about how people with AIDS should be treated at work and also how people who test positive should be treated at work. There have been instances where people with AIDS have been fired, and people who test positive, I think, have also faced discrimination in the workplace. Employers see it as their responsibility to protect the rest of their employees by someone who might be contagious. Is that a legitimate reason from the legal point of view for firing somebody who has AIDS or who tests positive?
Absolutely not. I think here's a situation where I would be in agreement with most management lawyers who look at this problem, or with, you know, personnel officials, say, in large employers. And everyone is in agreement that AIDS itself, or probably even the AIDS antibody, would be viewed as a handicapping condition or a disability that would be covered by either federal, state, or local non-discrimination laws. So an individual who even has AIDS, as long as they're well enough to work, and that's sort of the highest threshold example of someone's experience with this illness, that individual, if they're fired or even transferred to another position where maybe they won't have contact with coworkers or with the public, that would be unlawful employment discrimination. And already there's been a ruling in Florida by the Human Relations Commission there on a statewide basis that discrimination on the basis of AIDS is unlawful handicap discrimination. We'll see more of those cases, and I think we can predict very reasonably how they're all going to come out. They'll come out in the employee's favor. Now, you're asked about the co-workers' concerns, and co-workers do have some rights to a safe workplace. And what all you have to remember, though, is that having the person, even with AIDS, or who's tested positive on the antibody test, which is a less serious situation, those individuals don't pose any risk to the co-workers. And there have been complaints even of nurses, say, who don't want to care for someone who has AIDS in a hospital setting, making a complaint that it's an unsafe working condition. And those complaints have not gone anywhere. There are precautions that can be taken in the situations where there might be exposure to body fluids that might transmit the virus. And those precautions can be taken. But there's no reason to reassign the employee or fire the person who has AIDS as a way of dealing with that problem. What we really need to do is get what employers should do if they have this problem is get the sound scientific and medical information to their employees so that they understand that there's no risk to them of working with someone with AIDS.
Practically, we all know that if you're going to be fired for a reason that is legally controversial, you can just be fired for a different reason instead. If you have AIDS, you don't have to be fired because your employer tells you you have AIDS. You can be a little slow on the job lately or tardy at work in the morning. There are all kinds of excuses that you can use. So what would the legal recourse be practically for someone who was fired and they suspect it's because they tested positive or because they have AIDS?
Well, this is... So actually, you're absolutely right that employers oftentimes try to disguise what they're doing so that the illegality of their actions is not very clear to that employee. But with AIDS cases, it's not unusual for that to be the issue. That comes up. That's what triggers the firing. And it's really a really grossly unjust situation. Here's someone, if it's someone who has AIDS, they've probably recently been diagnosed as having AIDS so that they know they have this life-threatening illness. They're ready to sometimes go back to work or continue working. And the employer just tells them they no longer have their job. So it's almost, like finding out you have a life-threatening illness and then losing one's job. The traumatizing effect of that one thing after another is really an awful experience. I've seen that with my clients of how hard it is on the individual. And I think it's even a threat to their health when an employer acts that way. It is completely below the standards that we should expect of employers in this society. And I think that employers who do that, if they're stupid enough to fire someone or treat them as unfairly as that, they're going to find themselves in costly legal battles. Even if the individual has AIDS, they may die later, and the cases are probably going to continue anyway. And I think you'll find if the public is well educated to this problem, and it's not the too distant future when some of these cases may go to trial, that juries will be awarding significant punitive damages against employers that act this way against individuals with AIDS.
Briefly, there have been a few cases around the country where people have been charged basically for using their disease as a deadly weapon biting somebody or for spitting at someone, and this was before more was known about the saliva, because now doctors seem to agree that saliva doesn't transmit
That's right.
AIDS. But before that was known, someone was found, I think, guilty of felonious assault for spitting at an officer. Is this a big issue in the legal community now?
No, I don't think so. I think there are a few cases nationally where it's come up, and for some reason those cases have captured a lot of attention in the media. I don't think they deserve very much attention. They're very unusual. What I see with people who have AIDS or people in the gay community, which just as a community that is dealing with the as a kind of high-risk community, that people tend to act very responsibly. It's just the opposite kind of behavior. I mean, people are not knowingly engaging in sexual relations with people, knowing that they might transmit the virus. It's just the opposite, that there's a much changed consciousness about the risks, and certainly intentional acts like that are very unusual.
You, in addition to monitoring legislation on AIDS, you're also monitoring gay rights legislation. How do you think the AIDS epidemic has affected the ongoing fight for gay rights legislation?
Well, what it's done, I think, is it's distracted or sidelined the efforts to develop affirmative legal protection on the basis of sexual orientation. In other words, people are spending a lot of time now just working on these on AIDS legislation and usually just trying to get some completely ridiculous proposal from keeping it from going through and being passed into law. That's where the efforts are going now, instead of developing affirmative protection for people, say, on the basis of sexual orientation or other protections for lesbian women and gay men.
There are still sodomy laws on the books in some states. Because AIDS can be spread through anal intercourse, are those sodomy laws starting to be enforced in ways that they weren't before?
Well, where that is really an issue, an enforcement of those laws has always been fairly arbitrary and unfair, but that's just the nature of the government's attempt to criminalize activities like that. Those laws tend to get they tend to be enforced in a very unfair way. Now it's only a minority of states that have those laws. Pennsylvania does not, for example, hasn't since 1980. But where this is an issue, and it will be very significant, I'd expect sometime in the very near future, is when the Supreme Court will be deciding a case or perhaps two cases involving these statutes. And without going into all the technical legal arguments, and they are numerous, there are numerous arguments involved in these cases, the court may never really get to the merits of whether a state can criminalize those sexual activities, and it could be oral sex or anal sex usually involved. All I can say is that what's changed now regarding the sodomy statutes is the state's justification for those laws. It used to be just that the state, in arguing that they could criminalize those activities, was that the state was just enforcing morality, and that was really all that was the basis for the laws. More recently, either explicitly in arguments made in court, or I think it's just implication of the state's interest in promoting the health and welfare of the citizens. There's a kind of argument that by criminalizing these sexual activities, we're adopting a public health measure. And that, of course, is just a totally wrong approach to this. What you end up doing is stigmatizing people, kind of, especially with gay men, kind of putting them back in the closet by criminalizing their sexual activities. And that's just what we don't want to do at this point. We want to make individuals who may be in high-risk groups feel free to seek information that they can use to protect their health.
We heard earlier from a state representative who proposed a bill that, if passed, would require mandatory blood tests for the HTLV-3 virus for people seeking a marriage license and would prevent them from getting married if they tested positive. There are other current bills like that being proposed in the Pennsylvania legislature, do you know?
There are other things involving screening. There's one proposal that would allow county commissioners to impose mandatory screening for inmates in prisons or people in nursing homes. And I have difficulty figuring out what the point of any of those laws is. The marriage license proposal, for example, it seems to assume that everyone who gets married is going to have children. And the intent, in part, I suppose, is so that the two prospective spouses will know about each other, whether either of them have been exposed to the AIDS virus. It seems to me, though, that the state doesn't need to get involved in helping people make that determination, that it's something they should be able to determine themselves about whether they're going to enter into that relationship.
What kind of precedents do you think we're going to set now for the future in the way that we handle legislation concerning the spread of AIDS?
Well, it's very hard to say. I think we'll continue to see what are fairly crazy ideas in state legislatures. Issues come up or legislation is proposed which is supposed to address public health issues, but what really underlies that legislation is bias or prejudice against gay men and lesbian women, and that's really what is going on with a lot of these legislative attempts. So it may be just because of the unpopularity of the groups that are involved, the minority groups, that they may go through with a lot of this legislation. It may be up to the courts to rule on its constitutionality. I do not think most of these proposals would survive scrutiny in the courts.
Okay, thank you very much for talking with us. And I've been speaking with David Weber, who's the legal director for the Advocacy Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force.